The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
Day four, and the Ever Given remains a monster obstacle. A ship as long as the Empire State Building is tall. Satellite images show it wedged across one of the world's most vital shipping channels. Its owners say blown sideways by the wind. Salvage experts have been working round the clock to free it. They'll have to dig out as much as 3,000 tons of sand.
Frank, we are now in day four of this extraordinary situation with no end in sight. An effort was made earlier to try to refloat the Ever Given, to try to get it off of the sand back into the flow of the canal. That didn't work.
This is not only a big ship, this is one of the biggest container ships in the world. 20,000 of those containers that you see on the back of 18-wheelers, there's 20,000 of those on this. Now, a lot of people say, why don't they just unload the cargo? They can't. There's no cranes. The only way to get those containers off the ship would be by helicopter.
It's costing shippers an estimated $400 million every hour it's stuck, and it could lead to shortages of oil, coffee, and toilet paper.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
Washington is talking about adding more stimulus to the economy with a new infrastructure bill that could top $3 trillion, to be followed by massive tax increases. And we're seeing divergences in the market between the blue chip average like the Dow versus, let's say, the NASDAQ and the S&P. Hi, everyone. I'm Jim Poplavin. Welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me at the top of the hour will be John Kozar from Asbury Research. John's models are on a risk-off. He says the market is a coiled spring right now. You're going to want to listen to what John is following in the markets. Also later on, Greg Orrell from the OCM Gold Fund will be joining me. He says gold is poised for another run and the miners are minting money. Later on, it's going to be a special edition on The Big Picture. We're doing a piece called The Long Road Forward, Crash, Depression, Devaluation, and Inflation. You might want to sit in front of the fire with a nice glass of scotch. And before we get to that, let's find out what moved the markets this week with Ryan Poplava.
Well, it's been a very choppy 2021 so far in the stock market, and the past 2 weeks have been nothing different. Defensive areas of the market were taking the lead in the early part of the week as bond prices rallied until both the technical rally in the S&P 500 occurred at the 50-day moving average on Thursday, as well as the announcement from President Biden. He plans to unveil an infrastructure plan next week that is being reported to have around a $4 trillion price tag attached to it. On that note, it was interesting that on Monday, the New York Times published an article that the Biden administration is considering a tax hike to help pay for this new bill. And what I mean by interesting was that the stocks barely flinched on the news and still advanced. The administration called the report premature and not on par with what the White House is thinking. So I guess we'll just have to wait until next week to find out just how the President Biden plans to pay for it. If you recall, we have mentioned in the past that Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen believes a tax hike would be necessary to foot such a bill. Jim's interview with Chris Hennessy early this week is one to listen to if you want to get some sort of idea on the latest rumors going around on potential increases to tax and where they would find that increase. Okay, beyond the infrastructure news, there wasn't a lot of key catalysts that moved the market, but there's still plenty for us to talk about. One underlying factor we think may be influencing the defensive stance in the stock market this week is, of course, the rise in interest rates, but also the extent that Europe is still under lockdown. And news Tuesday that Germany and the Netherlands were extending those lockdowns further our concerns. In Europe, they are calling it the third wave of COVID, which has come at the same time as growing anger, which is spreading about the slow pace of vaccinations based on struggles to agree to contracts and by a large shortfall in doses from AstraZeneca, The Guardian reported on Wednesday. The European Commission head Ursula von der Leyen said this week the EU has exported 77 million doses to 33 countries as the largest exporter right now, as the EU leaders hold virtual talks to try and improve supplies and distribution this week. The BBC reported that out of 100 people, 45 have been vaccinated in the UK, while only 13 per 100 in the EU as a whole. So some room for improvement for the rest of the EU. Lastly, one more news piece about COVID. The CDC said cruise line restrictions will stay in place until November 1st, even though there's been some calls to phase in activity starting in July, according to Bloomberg. On Wednesday, Intel announced it will be investing $20 billion to build 20 semiconductor manufacturing facilities in Arizona, which boosted the shares by 6%. And I bring this up because usually when Intel announces a capital expenditure plan of this degree, it just reverberates through the other semiconductor industry shares. Finally, on the market news to add here, the Federal Reserve announced that the temporary and additional restrictions on dividends and share repurchases will end for most financial firms after June 30th, after the next round of stress tests are completed. But last I checked, materials, energy, and industrial sectors were the best performing stock sectors on Friday, adding to performance Thursday, again on that news about an infrastructure bill to be unveiled next week. In the economic news, existing home sales dropped 6.6% in February. Supply is still driving up prices and leading to affordability pressures. And new home sales declined 18.2% in February as well. The key in both reports is likely due to the deep freeze in the Midwest and South during the month, which saw sales decline due to the weather conditions. Durable goods orders fell 1.1% in February on the back of previously strong results from prior months. Looks more like a reprieve than an inflection point in our mind. Initial jobless claims continue to decline in a sign that the economy continues to recover and reopen, down to 684,000 claims, down almost 100,000 for the week ending March 20th. Consumer sentiment increased in March, boosted by stimulus and better vaccine distribution. So that sums up the week in finance. Stay tuned next week as Biden unveils his next big project, an infrastructure bill, possibly near that $4 trillion mark, as reported, and hopefully some news on how he plans to pay for it, possibly with higher taxation. Stay tuned.
Jim Paulson, chief investment strategist at the Luthold Group, told FS Insider listeners this week that the U.S. is poised for major growth and provided his outlook on what this means for inflation, Fed monetary policy, and how he is investing around these trends. Here's a clip of what he told listeners.
We get a growth rate this year that's anything close to what I'm thinking. It's going to be one of the strongest real growth years in post-war history. The pandemic has completely synchronized the entire global economic cycle, all in the same pattern of bust to boom. And they're all doing the same thing at the same time. And to the extent that the U.S. companies are not just going to see greater demand coming from U.S. citizens, but they're going to see it coming from every buyer across the globe at the same time, also experiencing some of their strongest growth in post-war history, adds to the upside leverage here.
If you want to listen to this full interview with Chief Investment Strategist Jim Paulson at the Luthold Group, in addition to all of our other interviews airing 3 days during the week on FS Insider, either through our website, financialsense.com, or through a mobile podcast app of your choice, go to financialsense.com and hit the subscribe button.
If you're seeking financial advice and how to invest in today's markets, Financial Sense Wealth Management can help. From setting up or providing advice on 401k plans, managing corporate cash balances in a zero interest rate environment, to helping individuals, foundations, and businesses achieve their financial goals. Give Financial Sense Wealth Management a call today at 888-486-3939. Let us work together to help you get on the path to success. Call now at 888-486-3939. Financial Sense Wealth Management has been named as one of the top investment advisory firms in the U.S. by the Financial Times. Let us put our financial expertise to work for you. Call now at 888-486-3939 or email grow at financialsense.com. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, stocks still have been heading higher, but looks like we've got a few hiccups on the way. Is this a correction? The market seems coiled in like a spring, but which direction will it head? Well, let's find out. Joining us from Asbury Research is John Kozar. John, let's begin with your tactical model and the Asbury 6, because you've got, I guess you call it your correction protection model. What's that telling you now?
Correction protection model has been risk off as of March the 4th. So what it did this time was a little bit more subtle. The last big signal it had was it had us out of the market last year between February 24th and March 23rd. And that kind of made most of our year because we reengaged pretty close to the bottom. It was out of the market February 24th and got back in on April the 9th. So we certainly didn't catch the bottom, but we were close. This time, we are risk off as of March the 4th. That was right when we were testing that underlying support level on the S&P 500, right around the 50-day moving average. We've tested it three times over the past month. The model kept us from, you know, biting, so to speak, on that last test where the S&P came up and made fresh highs. And then it came right back down again, which is where it is now. It's right back on that support level again. So this time that model has just told us, don't bite on the next test of support and wait to see if things get better. And they haven't yet. And actually CPM, the ingredients, so to speak, are several different indicators that I have built over my career, and we've back tested them. None of them has to do with the price of the S&P 500 or the price of any index. They're all internal indicators, and we did that on purpose so we get past the crazy algo-driven kind of market, you know, that, you know, is a reality now. The S&P is up 50 today. It's down 40 tomorrow. It's up 70 the next day. So we kind of went around price and used the CPM as a lie detector test. And right now it's telling us to be careful that the market is breaking down a little bit internally, even though it's been holding up price-wise.
So when you take a look at, the S&P hugging that 50-day, let's talk about the NASDAQ. I mean, because tech was the darling of the market last year, especially what I call the Fab Five, the big tech stocks from Amazon to Google to Tesla to Netflix. That sort of drove the market. And then you had those COVID stocks. But if I look at the NASDAQ now, it's struggling.
Yes, that's a lot of what I've been paying attention to. Is if you just look at the S&P 500, you're like, man, this thing is really resilient. It gets down to that 50-day and it's, you know, Pavlov dog ring, bell rings, everyone jumps in and buys the dip. That's what we've been trained to do. The Fed's been largely responsible for a lot of that kind of mentality. Fed's got your back, buy the dip. But if you look at both of the NASDAQs, I actually have the chart up here. Both of the NASDAQ started underperforming the S&P 500 since the middle of February. And while that's been going on, you've got the Dow has been outperforming since, pulling up that chart, since right around that same time. Right around the middle of February, you saw the NASDAQ start to underperform the S&P 500. You saw the Dow start to outperform. That is a defensive rotation in the market that you see when the market itself hasn't broken down. The S&P 500 hasn't, you know, broken down to the point, you know, where people are starting to pull the plug and maybe go into cash. But the character of the market is changing. People are not, risk appetite is starting to shift from, you know, get me on the fastest horse, you know, which the NASDAQs are, you know, to get me on the sure-footed burro, you know, which is what the diamonds are and what the Dow 30 is. That's what you're seeing. And interestingly, while the S&P 500 is holding that underlying support area, which is right now, it's right around 3,900. We're trading at around 3,933. So we're sitting right on top of that. But in the comp, in the NASDAQ Composite Index, we broke that level beginning of March, March 4th and March 5th, and now we came back up to retest it as a overhead resistance level and are rolling back down. So what does that mean? It means the tech has actually broken what I would call the tactical support level, but the S&P 500 is hanging on by its fingernails, is what I see.
You know, the thing that really strikes me, John, is if you look at a chart at Amazon, probably one of the biggest beneficiaries of the lockdown, but that stock has gone sideways since going back to last September. So what's that telling you?
Well, you know, there's a lot, you know, those large names in tech, they all kind of look a little bit different. I mean, you know, some are doing better than others, but I've been watching Amazon for some time and watching the coiling that you're talking about that started right after Labor Day. But while it's been coiling underneath the hood, it's been underperforming. It's actually been underperforming since the beginning of November, and just kind of drawing a quick line here. It has underperformed the S&P 500 by almost 15% since November. So a lot of what I look at is relative performance. In other words, you may look at the stock and say, hey, it's really holding up quite well. But then if you look at it relative to the index or relative to the market, you start seeing it failing. That's part of this kind of rotation that's going on. And I just see a lot of faster horses. You know, when if the market is happy, optimistic, it's looking for the fastest horses to ride. When it starts to become cautious, you see it jumping off those faster horses and getting into more of the Dow 30 kind of stodgy stocks that people can still stay invested, but they can do so in a more conservative way. And that's what I've been seeing all over the place.
Let's talk about some sectors within the S&P, because as tech started to break down, you had the breakout with the Dow Jones industrial stocks. You started to see energy, financials, industrials do well. What's your take there? Is that money still staying in that sector, or is it exiting?
That's a really good question. One of our in-house models is called the SEAF model. It's S-E-A-F. It's for Sector ETF Asset Flows Model. And what we do there is we watch the asset flows in the 11 sector spiders, and we track in three different time periods what are the top two increases in assets for each of those time period for each of the 11. So in other words, which two for each time period have the biggest percentage assets in, and which two have the biggest percentage assets out? And that model went overweight energy and financials on November the 12th. Now, at the time I saw the signal for the first time, I was like, who in the right mind is going to want to buy energy and financials here? I think at the time, I think the yield of the 10-year was 65 or 70 basis points, 0.7% or whatever it might have been. But it started to see the money going in those two places. Those trends are still intact. And since November the 12th, I actually wrote this down, since the 12th, the energy sector has risen by 48% and outperformed the S&P by 36%. Those are crazy numbers. Meanwhile, the financials outright are up 27% and have outperformed the S&P by 15%. When those assets shift in the model and go somewhere else, that's when we will close those trades out. Now, they have given some back. I mean, everyone's seen that. They have given some back over the past 3 or 4 weeks. You know, they had actually better numbers about a month ago. But that's where the money continues to go to. And the places it's coming from are places like staples and technology. Technology has actually been one of the places that we've seen the biggest exodus of investor dollars coming out of.
Now, let's talk about what's going on within the Dow itself. You know, I'm looking at a chart of 3M, an industrial type stock, and this thing, you know, that's a fabulous looking chart, and it looks like it's non-stoppable at the current time.
Yeah, the Dow, I'm just pulling up 3M here to have a look. Yeah, this is a, you know, that's been a good stock. You know, I don't focus so much on the individual stocks in the Dow, frankly. You know, the Dow is 30 stocks, and I typically don't pay a lot of attention to it as an index, except relative to the S&P 500 because it tells me what people are thinking out there. Most of the time, when you're in a sideways to down market, that's when you see the Dow outperforming, and it's flip-flop for tech. If you see tech underperforming as it is now, typically it's when the S&P 500 is either going sideways or it's going lower. So again, although I don't pay a ton of attention to individual Dow components, as long as those stocks as a group continue to outperform the S&P 500, that tells me that the market is scared out there. Investors are scared, might be a little too aggressive a word. They're cautious. They're pulling in their horns. They're not making big bets, you know, right here. So even though, you know, you and I were talking off camera, so to speak, about all of the, you know, the stimulus right now in the economy and the pent up, you know, demand post COVID for airline tickets and restaurants and, you know, the like, I'm not seeing that in the indexes. I'm not seeing that in the relationship between, you know, the major indexes. And I think the mistake that a lot of people make, we were talking about this, is that, you know, you tend to look out your window and read the newspaper and turn on the TV and you say, man, things are all set to go crazy here. But trying to invest on that, you know, just that information, could be a dangerous venture, because there's very frequently, if not even most of the time right now, you know, the market's doing something that doesn't make sense. You know, April, May, and June of last year, when the market, you know, took off from the bottom, we were in the teeth of a pandemic, and, you know, the market had a giant year, you know, from April on, you know, through the end of the year. So I just try to, I'm getting off of, you know, your original question, but I try to keep focused on the data, and try and, you know, you have to be aware of what's going on around you, but you also have to understand that those two can be out of sync by months, it's sometimes quarters.
And when you see this risk off, you know, we've seen this play out over the last couple of years, risk on, risk off. If it was to flip and go back to, let's say, risk on, what would you like to see take place to confirm that?
Boy, is that a good question. I was just looking at a chart that had to do with that. You know, as a guy that's been doing this for 40 years, I'm constantly asking myself the question. It's easy to get hung up in your analysis and say, oh, look how bearish this is, or look how... I always ask myself the question, you know, where are you wrong? You know, what would have to happen on this chart or in this data series to flip the tables, you know, the other way? And, you know, oversimplifying a little bit, you know, because we're on a show here, you know, and try to keep it simple. But this kind of sideways coiling that you could see, I'm actually looking at a chart of the comp right now, the NASDAQ Composite Index. If we were to get back through the 50-day moving average in the comp, which I'm looking right here, ballparking it, it's about 13,400. If we got, and we're 13,000 even right now, let's call it. So another 400 points higher in the comp, and see those the relative performance numbers flip. In other words, start seeing tech outperforming again. Start seeing money coming out of the diamonds in the Dow 30 stocks. That's when I think we could see one more leg higher. And seasonally, you know, we're still good here. This is a seasonal backdraft. Seasonality is, you know, tertiary in my view. It's it certainly isn't something I, you know, would ever make an investment on. But if somebody asked me what would have to happen in the market in order to get, you know, the March and April rally right before the sell in May and go away syndrome, I would say tech needs to start doing a heck of a lot better. Above 13,400, 13,500 in the comp, that would be enough to that could light the fuse for one more run at higher prices you know, through the end of April, early May.
A final question. What's your take on interest rates? We've seen, you know, it's hard to believe, John, what has happened to bond investors. You know, you go back to last August when the 10-year was below 0.5%. And look where it's come right now. I mean, it got up to almost 1.75%. I mean, that's a hell of a move in interest rates.
Yes, it is. I'm so glad you asked that. We were so hung up on stocks here. I had forgotten. I actually wrote a piece in Forbes a couple of weeks back talking about the secular long-term significance of 1.37% to 1.47% in the yield of the 10-year note, the U.S. 10-year note. That level goes all the way back to November of 1945, which was right after the end of World War II. Just a big level on the chart that we had fallen through and stayed there for quite some time. We ran through that the other way just over the past month. I think that, to me, that looks like a secular, if not a generational, shift in the direction of interest rates. The proof of the pudding there, I think, is going to be now that you should see that 147, let's call it, 140-ish area, should now be, kind of a support level in terms of yield. That's where yields should bottom out. Very interestingly, yields are an animal that very much kind of moves from level to level. So I look at if I'm looking at the yield of the 10-year, I'm always looking at a close-only chart that goes back 10 years or more. So 170 was the next level, and it got right to 170. This is where we are right now. It got to 170. I think it got to 173 intraday, 1 or 2 days. And now we've backed off a little, and now we're in the middle to low 160s in terms of yield. If we get through 170, the next level on the chart is 2.05%. If that happens, I think that could put a little spook into the market and possibly affect equities. That may not be for another month or two, but those are the levels to watch there. About 140, 145 underneath in yield, 170 that we're negotiating now. And then if we get through there, a move to 205. I think a move over 2% in the yield of the 10-year would get the market nervous a little bit, and that could coincide or help to maybe push stocks into some kind of a correction, which is overdue. Stocks are definitely overdue for a correction.
Yeah, because what is interesting, if you take a look at the probably the last 10 years, if you were in stocks, you made money, bonds, you made money, and people are not used to seeing losses in the bond market. But if you look at TLT, which hit 170 or 170, and now it's down to 136. I mean, that's a big down move.
Yes, and what's interesting on the back of that is I just wrote this down before we had our call. I went through a lot of different markets and looked at some of the commodity markets that look like they're set to make another leg higher. And I've got steel, I've got oil, I've got base metals and metals and mining. So all in that area, lumber, is showing some signs of going higher from here. So you have higher interest rates, TIPS breakevens are significantly wider. You've got the signs of some commodity inflation. There's prices are going higher there. So all these things indicate strength, and at some point, I think all of those things will have an adverse effect on stocks. So stocks are overinflated here, by a number of different measures. Economy starting to heat up. You have all this pent up demand due to COVID. I think we could see some fireworks this summer. And if things continue to heat up, ultimately, I think it could at least trigger some kind of a decent correction in the stock market before we get into the fall.
Well, so for right now, as you take a look at the market, it's risk off until things change. As you mentioned, the market is kind of coiled, but we don't know which direction that's going to go. But right now, we're in a favorable time of the year. John, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out more of the research you guys do at Asbury Research, how could they do so?
I was going to do something different this time. We're going to put an offer out to those who are listening to the show for a 3-week free trial. We're going to run this from March 29, which is Monday, the Monday coming up, and run it through 4/9, April 9, which is 3 weeks. And all you need to do is go to AsburyResearch.com and go to the contact tab. And there's a little text box down at the bottom. Just say, I listened to Jim's show. Financial Sense, please give me a 3-week trial and we'll get that going and run it for 3 weeks and people kind of look at us real time.
All right. Well, listen, John, thanks for joining us as always. And until we talk again, stay safe and have a great weekend.
Copper is going to be the key commodity for a global infrastructure green energy push. So said Rick Mills at aheadoftheherd.com on FS Insider this week.
U.S. President Biden has promised a $2 trillion clean energy plan. This is on top of his infrastructure plan. And the $2 trillion clean energy plan is designed to decarbonize American electricity in 15 years and create a net zero emissions economy by 2050. So you've got renewable energy projects, new fuel economy standards, 500,000 new public charging outlets for electric vehicles by the end of 2030, a smart grid, 5G, and over the next few years, you're actually going to have a decline in copper production without massive amounts of money put into new discoveries.
To listen to this and all our other FS Insider interviews airing 3 days every week at financialsense.com or through a podcast app on your mobile device, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Well, given the amount of money printing and spending in Washington, there's talk about the return of inflation. What will this mean for the markets? And in specifically, what will this mean for gold and precious metals? Joining us on the program is Greg Orrell from OCM Gold Fund. Greg, let's talk about gold. It hit a peak last August where it took out the old peak that was reached back in 2011, and it looked like gold was going to fly higher, but since then, it's been heading down. What's going on here?
Well, Jim, one of the things that if you look at both, what's happened in the bond market and the gold market, they both peaked on August 5th when you started to have the reopening trade. That was at that point, I believe that was the date that Novavax came out with that they were coming out with a vaccine or had some promises of a vaccine. And so since that time, the market started to position for reopening. And so investors started to become, on a broader scale, started to become less defensive. And so you started to see the, bond yields start to go up and bond prices sell off, and gold prices also peaked and started to sell off into where we are today. So that's a large part of it.
So given that what we're doing, the Biden administration is going to spend the largest amount of fiscal stimulus in U.S. history. We had a $900 billion bill passed under Trump in December. We just got a $1.9 trillion stimulus bill with less than 10% for COVID. Now they're talking about a $3 trillion infrastructure bill. Why do you think gold hasn't sniffed that out yet and what that might mean for inflation?
Yeah, no, that's a good point. Why hasn't it sniffed it out? Historically, gold shares will be a precursor to the gold price moving up. And one of the things that we've been seeing is a contraction in the gold XAU ratio, which is telling us that there is a bid in the gold share market right now. And part of that could be that the miners have shown good discipline and other aspects. But, getting back to why hasn't the gold market sniffed it out yet? And I'll still go back to, there is still a sense in the marketplace that you don't want to own gold unless you really have to. And we've seen gold's been coming out of the GLD, I think, now we have about 25 consecutive days where GLD has, lost gold, which gives you an idea of where sentiment is in the gold market. And there's also the belief that, the rising rates are going to impact, the attractiveness of gold. And you know, that you might on a short-term basis, that trade, and some of it is related to the algos and pair trades that take place. In the short period of time, and maybe we're in that intervening period where that is impacting demand for gold. But I also look at what's going on in the physical market, and you see that there's a lot of stress that's been taking place on deliveries, mostly the small bars and coins, and that market's been very tight. So there has been positioning going on. We just are not seeing the price rise yet, and so I think we're going to get there, but we're probably in that bottoming phase right now, in this intermediate term bottom that we have.
You know, it's amazing, Greg, because if you go to any large gold site, if you want to get Silver Eagles, Gold Eagles, Maple Leafs, Krugerrands, I've seen Silver Eagles go for 30% to 40% premium over spot. You've got Gold Eagles going for 10% to 20% premiums. And then on top of that, you can't get it. I was on Kitco and I was looking at various gold products that they had, and I found one that they had. I went to order it, and it basically said not available in your region. So the disparity between the physical and paper market, I've never seen it this wide. Maybe you have a better handle on that in terms of history, but at least in 40 years of that I've been in the business, I've never seen premiums this high.
No, I mean, there haven't been. I mean, the scarcity on the physical side of especially retail products is something that I think is unprecedented. I was talking to a dealer not that long ago, and he said that it was tighter. This was a few weeks ago. He said it was tighter now than it was back in March when we saw the big premiums and the COVID stress at that time. And at that time, you were also dealing with refineries shutting down and also logistics problems of getting product into the marketplace. So there has been buying going on, and whether that's the individuals trying to sniff out some inflation and can see it coming, that's a possibility.
Now, what about the competition that's coming in from cryptocurrencies? In the day we're doing this interview, you've got Bitcoin at 55,000, almost 56,000. How much that is taken away from the gold market?
On the margin, it is probably taken away some demand. But at the end of the day, when I tell people about crypto, as I said, the premise is correct in that you're trying to position for this undisciplined money creation that's going on by central banks. The problem is that the vehicle has no history that gold has as money. It hasn't been tested in the marketplace. And the fact of the matter is that there's nothing stopping the Jim coin, Greg coin. We can come up with a million different cryptos. And so while you might have scarcity of a Bitcoin, you don't have scarcity in how many cryptos you can create. I think that's going to be one of the big flaws there going forward. But right now it's, people are chasing it. It's a number that's going up and down on the board, and folks get excited about that.
Let's talk about the gold stocks themselves, because, even at 1700 gold, little over that, these companies are mining gold for $1,100 and $1,200 an ounce. They're making a lot of money. And you see this reflected not only in the cash flow and the profits, but a lot of these miners have been really hiking their dividends.
Yeah, no, the miners, since I've been doing this for close to 40 years, yeah, this is the best the industry has looked to me. And it goes to being able to maintain capital discipline. These are lessons learned from the last cycle. And I recently saw the chart on capital, on equity issuance by the top 10 producers. And if you look at the gold XAU ratio, and it just blew out. It historically used to trade, you know, between 3 and 5 times, you know, the gold price. And in 2008, it just totally blew out. And I think ultimately it hit a peak of 26. You know, right now it's about 12.4 as we're talking today. And that contraction is coinciding with, you know, the contraction of equity that we're seeing, buybacks by Newmont and a number of the other producers that have been hiking their dividends, returning capital to shareholders. This was unheard of for many years in the industry. I mean, you know, historically they were serial equity issuers. And I used to say that, they debased their shareholders faster than the central banks were debasing their currency. And that's part of the lack of confidence that came into the industry in 2008. And I think it's been a really slow road to get that investor confidence back. It is taking place, but it's, you know, there's a lot of work that has to be done there.
If you take a look at all of this, you've got rising profits for the miners, but it's not being reflected in the stock. You're seeing it reflected in cash flow and dividends. Let's talk about gold and silver specifically. Gold is viewed as a precious metal. Silver is kind of a bifurcated market. It's part industrial, part precious metal. What's your take on silver?
Silver, you know, I still go back to that old adage, silver is poor man's gold. But for the silver price to go, I mean, a lot of people, you know, the GameStop crowd or the Reddit crowd that was trying to, you know, put a, you know, short squeeze in the silver market. You know, the silver is really needs the gold price to go to get pulled along, in my opinion. And you know, there will be, you know, capital that will flow down into the silver market as the gold price moves higher. And you know, that's going to be a sentiment driven. And I like silver. And I believe that, you know, there will be big demand there as the gold price moves higher and higher. But it does need the gold price to really launch first. I don't think that, you know, silver is going to pull gold. You know, where some people believe that that's going to happen, I don't believe that.
So, Greg, what is, in your opinion, the catalyst that's going to launch gold and silver? You know, we're seeing just massive amounts of money spending. I've never seen anything like it in my entire 40 career in the business. I mean, we may be spending $6 trillion on top of the regular government budget this year. At some point, there is got to be consequences to do that, because if we could do it, everybody else could do it. I mean, why not Zimbabwe, Argentina, or Venezuela?
Yeah, well, I mean, what you're really bringing up here is, you know, at what point does the Fed lose credibility? You know, right now they're walking this tightrope of credibility, in my opinion. And, you know, do they allow, you know, the, you know, interest rates to go up on higher inflationary expectations? And, you know, do they really back away from artificially suppressing rates like they have? You know, they know, and that, you know, as Alan Greenspan once warned, is that, and fretted about, was that, you know, you're going to get a cascading sequence of defaults if you let the market run on its own in terms of interest rates. Interest rates, you know, can really, you know, suck everything out of the economy, you know, at this point in terms of profits. So, you know, what I would see is that, you know, there's a emperor has no clothes moment that takes place. You know, and then sentiment changes on a dime towards gold, whether it's, you know, the inflation actually takes place and the market realizes the Fed can't do anything about it. And this is, you know, really boxed into a corner. And you also get the fact that, you know, they are printing money and handing out checks left and right. This, you know, these stimulus packages, you know, this is probably the beginning of more free money, where you get, you know, a sustenance allocation to folks where they get a guaranteed income. You know, at what point does the market wake up and say, you know, as Jim Grant once said, if it's so easily reproduced, what is it worth? And I would say that you're not that far away from that point coming. And it really is, you know, what point you have a sentiment change, and it can change very quickly.
So, Greg, what would you be doing here as an investor? I personally, even though they're in shortage and the supply isn't there, I just have a hard time paying a 30-40% premium over spot to buy a Silver Eagle or a 20% premium to buy a Gold Eagle. What would you be doing?
Well, yeah, so I tend to, obviously, because I am in the business of investing in the miners, you know, I believe that, you know, the ounces in the ground have been discounted for a long time by the marketplace. And you have a number of companies that are still trading, especially in the development side, they're still trading for, less than, $50, $80 an ounce of reserve in the ground, which is, you know, prices that, you know, were the same in 1980s. Yeah, that's, you haven't seen a big increase in the valuations for ounces in the ground. And so I believe the miners, you know, with the leverage and the discipline that has come into the industry, they offer the most attractive alternative for investors wanting to buy gold assets at this juncture. And, you know, right now I would say the way that the producers have acted is, you know, they offer some of the best options in terms of the miner of the gold mining space versus, you know, sometimes the exploration or intermediate producers look cheap versus, you know, senior producers. You know, I would say producers look, you know, very attractive right now. And it might be part of, Jim, one of the things you said is that, the miners haven't moved that much, you know, here of late, you know, and they are producing a lot of cash and returning cash to shareholders through dividends and buybacks. Yeah, you know, for a long time, the value stocks were out of vogue and everybody wanted growth. And that's still, you know, where the mindset is of a lot of folks. So you could probably make the case that, you know, the large cap miners have been turned into value stocks and nobody really wants value. And, you know, I would say that they represent very strong value right now for investors.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, as we close, if our listeners would like to find out about your OCM Gold Fund, how could they do so?
Well, OCMGoldFund.com is a good way to go about it. And from there, you can get the contact information if you want to get in touch with me. And you can also, you know, it's available on all the platforms, you know, out there in terms of, you know, Fidelity, Schwab, or your financial advisors, et cetera.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. You have yourself a great weekend.
Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
The global battery market is growing very quickly, but unfortunately, much of it is dependent on China. So says Randy Moore, president and CEO of Zaf Energy Systems, who joined FS Insider this week to discuss the major types of batteries that we see used today, and most importantly, how dependent America and other countries are on China for processed battery materials. His company experienced this firsthand during COVID, and he explains what they did and what he is advocating industries around the world do as well. Here's a clip of what he had to tell listeners this week on FS Insider.
Electrification of the drivetrain, the grid going green, all of that requires batteries, and batteries tend to be pretty nasty things in general. There was a study done a few years back that said that lead acid batteries are the number one and number three polluters in the planet.
If you want to listen to this full interview, go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Everyone wants to retire well. That's not as easy as it sounds. You need to make the right investment choices, decide when to take Social Security, plan for taxes on your retirement income, and create a legacy for your family. To retire well, you need a roadmap to help you get there. Let Financial Sense Wealth Management help you navigate your way to retirement. We provide comprehensive, thoughtful, and personal retirement planning. Call Financial Sense Wealth Management now at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. Start your journey to retiring well today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA, SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Welcome, everyone. Before we begin, just want to give you a heads up. You may want to get a warm blanket, sit in front of the fireplace, but you're going to want to break out the scotch. And maybe by the end of this, you may be going to brandy.
Yeah, Jim, we got a lot of great feedback from our show 2 weeks ago, The Death of Money and the Great Devaluation. Some of what we had to say in that big picture segment was a bit frightening. And so certainly some of the things that we're going to build on today from that show are going to probably require you to take a little bit of a sip of that scotch, I would say, because, well, we're going to be talking about some of the stimulus that's hitting, the lagged effects that are going to be coming from that, because as we discussed before, the initial signs of inflation are all good. It's what happens down the road. So that is what we are going to get into in today's big picture. And Jim, I want to say we talked with Jim Paulson, the very astute and extremely sharp chief investment strategist at Luthold Group this week on FS Insider. He believes that the U.S. is going to see the fastest growth in post-war history this year. And that's because there are some very powerful tailwinds behind this market. Clearly, a few trillion dollars of stimulus is one thing that we can be looking at.
Yeah, I want to begin with some of the things that we're going to cover, because as we talked about in a show a couple of weeks ago, we cited from Genzo Parsons' book, Dying of Money, and that is the initial signs of stimulus, the things that we're doing, they're all good. You've got growing deficits, expanding financial markets, and economy. And as we're going to talk about here, when you're going to throw $6 trillion of stimulus.
Wait, Jim, did you say $6
trillion? Yeah, that's a T, Chris. It's not a B. It's not billion. It's trillion. As Everett Dirksen used to say, a billion here and a billion there. You're talking about real money. Well, with inflation today, we use the word trillion. So let's talk about what's hitting the economy. So in December, the Trump administration passed a bipartisan agreement on $900 billion of stimulus, which included a $400 check. The Biden administration just passed a $1.9 trillion stimulus, and less than 10% of that was actually COVID-related. So let's just round these numbers off and just say there's $3 billion of stimulus that's in the pipeline that's going to hit the markets this year. And it may be one of the reasons why, as we'll get to later on, why you're seeing the bond market back up. But it doesn't stop there. Now, originally, they were talking about a $2 trillion stimulus for infrastructure for the Green New Deal. Now that figure, Chris, has been bumped up to $3 trillion. And they've also hinted at the $1.9 trillion stimulus is going to supplement unemployment benefits. And that will run out September 6th. And they've hinted that when that runs out, there will be another stimulus. So, Chris, God knows where this is going to be. It could be right now we're headed for $6 trillion. It could end up being $7 trillion if they do another stimulus at the end of the year, because we may be getting into trouble then, which we're going to get into. But here's the thing you have to understand. None of this stimulus is paid for. Now, they're talking about the infrastructure bill that they are going to pass. And Janet Yellen said that the taxes are going to have to be much larger than they originally thought, because instead of $2 trillion, now they're talking $3 trillion. And we're going to talk about the consequences of those taxes, because we don't have the money to pay for it. So we're either issuing debt, the Fed's printing money to pay for it, and then they're talking about raising taxes, and we're going to get into why this doesn't work, and we're going to show you the evidence. Now, bear in mind, a lot of the stuff you're going to hear today is probably stuff you're not hearing on Wall Street and the mainstream media, but we're going to give you the facts. We're going to give you data information from not only the U.S. government, the Treasury, and St. Louis Fed. So we're just not making this stuff up. You will actually be able to look at the stuff that we're talking about. So, and then in addition to that, when we finally close at the end of the segment, we're going to have a reading list for you so you can read what others are saying and why they believe the things that we are telling you in today's broadcast.
And you know, Jim, we mentioned this 2 weeks ago as well. There's a website called COVID Money Tracker by the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. And they provide all the numbers as well in terms of the amount of stimulus that's being deployed into the market right now. And actually, you said $6 trillion. That's what's been dispersed. But the amount that is actually allowed, that is legislatively been allowed and committed, is up to $13 trillion. So we're only halfway there in terms of how much money could be down the pipeline should we see any economic weakness, faltering of the financial markets. So like we have said on our show, ever since we saw that first major MOAB hit the economy back in, 12 months ago, we should be expecting more carpet bombings of mothers of all stimulus bombs for, if not months, years to come.
Oh, absolutely. And what you've got, and we've got to go back to MMT, which is modern monetary theory. And under MMT, they treat the Treasury and the Fed as one entity. And this is what we talked about, the fusion of fiscal policy with monetary policy. And this is a lot different than what took place after the financial crisis in 2008 and 2009, because the Fed printed a lot of money, but the bulk of that money stayed on the Fed's balance sheet. This is much, much different. This is government actually spending money, sending you checks, those checks you get in the mail, sending you money, directing that money directly into the economy, and then the Fed is just simply going to print the money to pay for it. And, you know, modern monetary theory is being heralded as this grand new economic theory. Basically, it's old wine in a new bottle. It's nothing more than printing money. Its main proponent is Stephanie Kelton out of Stony Brook University. She's got a new book out called The Deficit Myth. I highly recommend you read it and you'll understand the logic. Because according to MMT, if you can print money in your own currency, you don't have to worry about deficits. You don't have to worry about debt because it's basically money you owe yourself and the government can simply print it. Now, there's one caveat there, which we're getting into and what we are internally at our firm monitoring for the pivot point, and that is inflation. Now, according to MMT, inflation is not a big issue because you just simply raise taxes. Well, we're going to raise taxes. And what we could see this year is the largest tax increase in U.S. history. We'll get into that in a minute and why that's going to be a mistake. But as you go through this cycle, and as you go through, as we talked about in the Great Devaluation, if you follow the cycle, let's go back to 1929, begins with the stock market crash, then you see government policy response, and typically it's the wrong kind of response. And that follows by a depression. With the depression, you get deflation. And then response to that deflation, you get devaluation, and then you get inflation. So if you take a look at 1929, stock market crash, Hoover comes in with all kinds of things to manipulate the economy, all the wrong policy moves. He raised tax rates to 68%, and then the Dow lost close to 90% of its value. Roosevelt comes in, the first thing he does the first week of office is devalue the currency against gold, going from $20 an ounce to $35 an ounce. He ended deflation instantaneously. In the month of March, his first month in office, we went from deflation to inflation, and we had a four-year upcycle in the market, the economy, and inflation that was later destroyed by tightening of money, raising interest rates, and raising taxes to 94%. We'll get into that more as we get into this.
So, Jim, obviously, you know, in this segment, the big picture, we're looking forward. And as we discussed 2 weeks ago, we're now in the early stages of inflation where all the inflationary impacts are good, right? You can pump in all these trillions of dollars of stimulus. Asset prices are climbing, whether or not you're looking at stocks, housing. But then later is when we start to see the bad aspects of inflation. And clearly that's the big debate now. It's a question of how soon that is going to come. But at some point, we probably are going to have to come to terms with all of the impacts of the trillions of dollars of stimulus that are being thrown into the economy. Where does that lead? Well, this is now where we get into the scary part. This is where you're going to have to now take another sip of that scotch, perhaps.
Yeah, or keep the bottle right next to you.
Because there are some out there, including yourself, that are talking about we need to be thinking about another depression down the road. So let's get into that.
Okay, I want to read something that Jim Rickards quotes Mohammed El-Erian in his new book, The New Great Depression. And this is a quote from Mohammed El-Erian in Foreign Policy in May of 2020. He said, "Only a few months into the tragic COVID-19 shock, there are already concerns that Wall Street is once again flourishing while Main Street is suffering. If current asset prices fail to be validated by a decisive economic recovery, the longer-term well-being not just of the economy and markets, but of institutions and society as well, will be at risk." And that's the thing that we got to talk about, Chris, because you're not seeing this reflected in the financial reports. But as a result of the lockdowns, 60 million Americans were put out of work. Just to give you a sort of a flavor of what this means, hundreds of thousands of businesses are bankrupt. Just in the city of New York City alone, 97,966 businesses went bankrupt. That's one-third of the 230,000 businesses will never reopen again. If you take a look at some of the marquee names that we've seen in retailing and business, JCPenney's, Pier 1, J. Crew, Neiman Marcus, Hertz, Gold Gym, Chesapeake Energy, all gone bankrupt. And so, as Rickards is talking about, one of the things that you are not hearing with these 60 million Americans that lost their jobs. Now, as the economy begins to reopen, some of them are going back to work. But we're going to include a graph that's very, very important for you to look at. And that's the labor participation rate. And that is down to a little over 61%. It used to be as high as 68. Now, what that means is there are a lot of people that are able to work, but are not working and not looking. So let's say you got laid off as a result of COVID. You're not looking for work because obviously you're getting a nice pay with these stimulus checks that they're sending. You are no longer counted in government statistics as being unemployed. You still are. You don't have a job. You're not working. But the government ceases to count you. So when you look at the unemployment rate, it really isn't a true reflection of what is taking place in the economy. And so that labor participation rate, and if you take a look at 80% of the unemployment benefits that are being distributed, the people that are receiving them are making more money than not working. So, you know, Chris, if they had, I've seen over the, probably the last couple of weeks, they've had various business owners from restaurant owners to gym owners to service people, and they're complaining, "We're hiring, but I can't get anybody to work. Why would you come and work for me? Let's say I'm going to pay you $10, $11 an hour because, you know, you're working at McDonald's or wherever you're working, when you can actually make more money and have more take-home pay by not working." So you're interfering with this job process by enabling people not having to work. And that's one of the issues that we're going to be dealing. So this unemployment rate and the subsidies that are going to have to go along with it are going to continue well into the future, because this is not going to go away in the short term. It may be to the year 2023 or 2024 before we get back to employment rates that truly reflected the way they were before COVID-19 hit.
So we've been discussing on our podcast for a few years now the number of parallels that we see between the 1920s and the 2020s. And I think we could all say that when you look at valuations where they are currently, a lot of the pent-up demand post the 1918 Spanish flu, global pandemic that existed at the time, and then now with COVID, these parallels are certainly playing out. And clearly, we're in the midst of this 2020s boom, especially when we think about the trillions of stimulus again being thrown at the markets and the economy. However, one of the things that you were telling me was with regards to some of the policy decisions that were made, not just in the 20s, but also into the 30s after the crash. Do you mind sharing a bit of your insights in terms of the historical parallels that we see with policy then and today?
After the stock market crash in 1929, Hoover was sort of one of those analytical. He was an engineer type. And the feeling was he wanted to maintain wage rates, even though the country was going through a recession at that time. And businesses were, you know, losing sales as the economy declined. He thought, well, if we could keep wage rates up, people will have the money to spend and consume. Therefore, it will help the economy. It didn't, because what happened is businesses had to keep labor rates up while the cost of goods and services they provided were falling with deflation. It's no different than what we're doing today by talking of raising the minimum wage to $15. So, I mean, imagine yourself, you own a gym, or let's say you're a restaurant owner in New York or any big city. You've been shut down with the initial COVID response. Then we opened up. And when we opened up, you were opened up in a limited fashion. In other words, you had to either serve your customers outside or you could only operate at 25% capacity. So you were given money to keep your employees on payroll, but why would those employees stay on payroll when they can make more money being unemployed? So that's number one. Number two is, you know, you're competing with unemployment and wages. The last thing you need as a businessman when you can't operate at full capacity, and, you know, restaurants, they make a lot of their money from alcohol. So maybe your profit margin on food covers your labor costs, but your profit margins come from, you know, selling alcohol. And if you're just doing takeouts, Chris, I don't know too many people that go to restaurants and say, okay, I'm going to order a steak dinner to go. But by the way, I'll have two glasses of wine to go. Most people will serve their own wine at home. So a source of profit margin for restaurants is just simply not there. The other thing we did during the Great Depression is they wanted to support agricultural prices. And the idea was they were fighting deflation by trying to maintain prices artificially high. It did not work. You distorted the economy. If we look at the stock market in the 1920s, one of the innovations that Wall Street came up with was investment trusts. It was a way for the average American to put money in something and participate in the market. And this wave that came in through these investment trusts, and especially as you got to the latter part of the 20s, kept driving that market to levels that we saw PE ratios of 30, 40, and 50. It's no different today than index funds and ETFs. What also happened coming out of the Great Depression? We had the Smoot-Hawley tariffs. Well, take a look at the Trump administration that began implementing tariffs the first year of his administration. And look what's happened to international trade and the tensions. The other thing that they were trying to do is encourage people to consume money. Well, let's talk about where we are today. One of the things that we've seen with these stimulus checks, a lot of people are keeping that stimulus in savings accounts, or maybe they're investing or day trading, but certainly they're not going out and spending splurge if you look at the savings rate. Now, one of the things that economists are talking about is all this pent-up demand as of COVID with all this cash sitting on the sidelines. But if you're uncertain as to your own health, about this virus, about this economy, about your own job, your safety of your own job. In other words, is your job at risk of being laid off? Are you going to go out and be spending money? No, you're going to be cautious. You're going to be holding back. And the same thing happened during the Great Depression. So as much as they were trying to push people to go out and spend money, when you're seeing banks go under, the unemployment rate go up, the economy contract, you're probably not likely to go out and spend that money. The other thing that they made, a major mistake, is they raised taxes. Now, the income tax was put into effect in 1913. It was at 7%. But when we got into World War I, Wilson raised the tax rates to 77% to pay for the war. We had a brief depression from 1920 to 22, and then it recovered. And so what you did after Wilson left office, The next president came in and he lowered tax rates to 25%, where they remained until 1932. Hoover's critical mistake is he raised the income tax rates to 63% in 1932. Now, what Roosevelt did, he came in to get rid of deflation. He devalued the dollar, which got rid of deflation instantaneously. We saw a 3 or 4 year boom in the economy. We saw it in the markets. But then they made a critical mistake. The Fed started raising interest rates. Roosevelt raised tax rates to 79% in 1936. And then, of course, with the war, he raised tax rates to 94%. Now, if you take a look at when they happened before, Reagan brought tax rates down from 70 to 28. Clinton raised them from 39.6, where they pretty much remained, except for George W. Bush lowered the tax rates to 35. And under Trump, they were lowered to 37. Biden will raise those to 39 and beyond. So here's the thing you have to understand about taxes. We're going to show you a graph, and it's from the Tax Policy Center. It shows you basically what government takes in tax revenues in percentage of GDP. It does not matter if the tax rate's 28% or 94%. The government doesn't take more than 17 to 19%. And you can see this graph going back to 1913. And the reason you're going to see that is capital is mobile. I mean, we run a wealth management firm, and already our clients are saying, what are we going to do to minimize our taxes with the tax increases coming up? And we've already figured out ways to get around it. That's what we do in this business. That's what tax lawyers do. That's what financial advisors do. You get a tax increase, how are you going to minimize that? Tax behavior changes. People take evasive action. They can avoid, for example, taking capital gains, or they can switch into tax-free investments, tax-free bonds, life insurance, Roth IRAs. There's various ways you go around it, or you simply just put the capital overseas if the dollar's at risk here. So basically, what we're seeing now, and this is just my opinion, you're starting to see the market kind of wake up. Wait a minute. On top of the stimulus, you got another $3 trillion, and you got people like Biden. You've got people like Janet Yellen. You've got people at the Fed saying that, you know, we need to raise taxes. Yellen came out and said we may have to raise taxes more than we were originally concerned. So what does that mean? If you raise the corporate tax rate from 21 to 28%, that's a 40% increase. What do you think that's going to do to profits? The same thing that happened when Trump lowered tax rates from 35 to 21, you saw the market spike in 2018 because corporate profits went up. Because obviously, if you're paying tax rates at 21% versus 35, you have more profits, and the market responded. What do you think the market's going to do when you remove capital gains treatment, when you remove favorable dividend treatment, and you raise tax rates to over 50% or corporate taxes from 21 to 28%, that may explain some of this nervousness you're seeing in the stock market. And I want to point out, even when tax rates were high, like 70% prior to Reagan coming into office, and then eventually he took tax rates from 70 down to 28. Chris, when I got in this business, I didn't pay taxes. The only taxes I paid were Social Security. Because even though the tax rates were at 70%, you had all kinds of tax shelters. You could invest in real estate, and any losses that were generated in real estate, the excess losses, you could use that against your ordinary income to bring your taxable income down. You know, in my case, I just bought a tax shelter. I ran my tax software in December, looked at what my taxable income is, and I did a two and a half or three to one tax shelter and zeroed out my taxes. And that's the way it worked until 1986, when Reagan got tax reform. He said, look, a lot of people are spending money in unproductive areas to avoid taxes. We're going to lower the tax rates. At that time, the tax rates were 50. So we're going to lower it to 28, but we're going to get rid of the tax deductions for tax shelters. We're going to get rid of excess losses on real estate. You can offset your income. We got rid of sales taxes. We got rid of a lot of things that you could use to reduce your taxable income, because Reagan said, we would rather have you pay maybe a lower tax rate, but invest money productively rather than unproductive behavior. And what's going to happen, Chris, is as we raise tax rates back up to 70%, we are probably going to get involved in unproductive behavior, because we're going to start, and we are already identifying ways to get around this tax loophole. Now, let me share this with you. You think, oh, that's terrible that, you know, wealthy people do this. Folks, it's done intentionally. Congress, you know, the Senate has all millionaires. Everybody that's in the Senate is a millionaire. They don't want to pay high taxes, so they put in these loopholes that they themselves use. And remember, a lot of their income is non-taxable because they get an expense allowance that they can spend a whole bunch of money that's non-taxable. So these loopholes are put into the tax law for specific rewards to those that contribute to their campaign. That's the way the system works. So when you do this, like I said, capital is mobile. It's going to shift. It's going to go into unproductive areas to avoid taxation, which is unproductive for the economy.
You know, it's funny, Jim, because even this post on federal receipts as a percent of GDP, you know, showing that it's basically flatlined for the past 70 or so years, despite increase or lowering of taxes, just been flat. There's a blog post that they have about this. And the writer, who's clearly a researcher at the Federal Reserve, St. Louis Federal Reserve, they just have a lot of questions. They can't answer. Why has it been flat? You know, I mean, that's the thing is policymakers, they can look at the data and see, oh, okay, when we raise taxes, it's not leading to more tax revenue. Rather than saying, okay, well, then in that case, let's just make our tax code more efficient. They just say, well, we don't know why that is. It's like it's staring them in the face, but yet they're unwilling to come to what is the common sense solution of let's just make it more efficient and simple.
And we're going to get into this because it's psychological. As we get into talking about inflation, it's psychological, and we'll get to that in just a minute. But that's what they don't see. People change their behavior. I can't tell you the number of calls that we're getting in now because a lot of people are saying, you know, the kind of tax rates they're talking about are confiscatory. What am I going to do to offset that? Wealthy people don't just sit there and say, okay, I'll just pay the tax. No, they're going to take evasive action. So let's talk about where we're going, because there's a sequence of events that follows this. Like right now, with all of this stimulus, which could be up to $6 trillion, and as you pointed out, total of $13 trillion. It's nonstop. Just as we saw money printing continuously coming out of the financial crisis, we're going to see fiscal stimulus continuously going forward because monetary policy is ineffective by itself now because we're at 0% interest rates. So a lot of people are saying, and this is what Mohammed Arian was talking about when he wrote in Foreign Affairs, there's a disconnect between Wall Street and Main Street. If you look at the market's response last year, it wasn't going up because corporations were making a ton of money. Now, there were exceptions to that and what we call the COVID stocks or the FANG stocks, you know, the Microsofts, the Amazons were big beneficiaries of the COVID lockdowns because people were buying more stuff online. We're, you know, communicating more online with Teams, with Zoom, and those kind of companies. In fact, we've created, there's an article written by Frank Barbera on this site, and we've got the 30 nifty, what we call tech stocks. And right now they're signaling that trouble is ahead. So you want to read Frank's article. But the market multiples in many sectors of this equity market are at what we call bubble-like qualities. I mean, Tesla worth the entire auto industry globally. And so here's the issue that we're monitoring. And you're not going to see this reported in government statistics. A lot of people say that, you know, the PCE, the Fed's favorite inflation indicator, really truly doesn't measure inflation that you and I experience on Main Street. So we're looking at a pivot point because when inflation starts to surface, you're going to see a concomitant rise in interest rates as we're seeing now. And that is going to create a derating of equities and the rise of volatility. So when eventually you get to that pivot point, that is when you're going to start seeing the smart money start to exit the market and unload it. Wall Street will be bullish as ever, just as we were in March of 2000, as we were in October of 2007, and as we are today, gleefully talking about just, you know, Wall Street loves money printing. Wall Street loves spending money. But as we talked about, there is going to be a pivot point, at which time you're going to want to be start building short positions in tech, green tech, cryptocurrencies, and you are going to start seeing money offshore. It will start going into emerging markets because of what's coming to the dollar. And you're already seeing part of that right now. So there is going to be a shift. And Chris, the one thing that policymakers don't understand is human psychology. People will do anything to avoid pain, loss in the financial markets, or loss of personal net worth through taxation. They will take evasive action. And likewise, if you are sitting right now, not, you know, you're worried about, gosh, I don't know about the business I'm working in, you know, if I'm going to have a job at the end of the year. And that's why you're seeing these savings rate. Now, Wall Street is saying, look, there's pent-up demand. There's a lot of money in cash that if consumers can get persuaded to spend that money, we could see growth rates in the economy. Chris, they're talking 6 to 8%. We haven't seen 6 to 8% growth rates. I can't remember when. But if we do see 6 to 8%, it won't be permanent. It'll only last for a while because once inflation, once that money starts working its way into the economy where you have fewer goods and services that are being produced because of the number of businesses that have been put out of business by government policy, you have fewer manufacturing. There's manufacturing bottlenecks right now. Just go out and try to order exercise equipment. We're trying to get at our house. My house is solar powered, but in California, we got rolling blackouts. And so we have to have a contingency plan. And Chris, I'm on a waiting list to get Tesla batteries. I have solar panels that run the house, but when they have a rolling blackout, doesn't matter if you have solar, you know, power is turned off to your house. So to counteract that, we're on a waiting list to get Tesla batteries. I'm told I won't be able to get it to October. We're trying to get infrared heaters on a new outdoor facility that I'm building, and I'm told I can't get them because all the restaurants have bought them because of outdoor dining. So a lot of this, there is a shortage of labor. There's a shortage of material goods. There's a shortage in the number of businesses that are operating. There's a shortage of the number of businesses that are service-oriented that are operating. A lot of these companies, literally millions of companies that have gone under. As I mentioned, what was that figure I picked up the other day out of the journal? 97,966 businesses alone in just New York City will not be reopening.
So, Jim, where is all of this heading? And I want to point to something that we talked about our last show. We titled The Great Devaluation, and you mentioned how you believe that we are going to see the US dollar devalued massively because of the large debts. You know, one thing that someone had brought up, a listener from that show, was that how is it that the US can devalue? Aren't we going to see all other countries devalue relative to the dollar? So in that sense, it's not going to be the US dollar devaluing against other currencies. Everyone will be doing it at the same time. And I think that is an interesting question to think about. How does this play out in that sort of environment?
Oh, that's a perfect question because that's where we're going next. First thing that happens usually with the stock market crash is you get into this deflationary type cycle. Asset prices drop. When asset prices drop, people get circumspect on spending. And then you start seeing goods, the price of goods drop. It's the response that comes and follows that, which will eventually be devaluation. And the reason I'm saying that is right now we'll probably end up over $30 trillion in debt by the time we get to this year. And by the time in the next couple of years, we could be at $40 trillion. So the question is, how do you make that debt sustainable? It's very easy. We've done it before. We did it after World War II. It's called financial repression. So if you could, let's say the Fed, through managing the yield curve, can keep interest rates around 2, 2.5%, maybe no more than 3, but run inflation rates that are 4 and 5%, you eventually deflate that debt away. So as your nominal value of GDP continues to go up with price increases, the value of that debt becomes less and less and becomes more sustainable. Well, how do you devalue, as this listener talked about? You know, let's take the major currencies. We have this kind of artificial currency regime that is manipulated. You've got the yen, you've got the euro, you've got the dollar, and then you've got the British pound. So when you take these currencies, if we were to devalue our currency against the euro, the yen, or the other currencies, it's a beggar thy neighbor policy. What they're going to do is they're going to devalue. So you devalue, they match it, they devalue. That doesn't work. The way you devalue is you do what our presidents do. You devalue against gold. Roosevelt did it in 1933. Nixon did it in 1971. Now, he devalued by separating gold from backing the dollar. His original intention was to revalue gold and attach it to the dollar. But unfortunately for Nixon, he got involved in the presidential election of 72. Then we had the Watergate hearings. He resigned, and eventually that the dollar was never relinked to gold. But what we did have is a gold standard for investors, because in 1974, President Ford allowed Americans to own gold again. And of course, we saw what happened. Gold eventually went to 800. Now, there are some experts out there that think that gold, when we devalue, that the price of gold is going to be $10,000 to $14,000. Jim Rickards, in his new book, The New Great Depression, thinks it's closer to $4,000. Now, you may be listening to that and thinking, God, Jim, you're off your rocker. You're crazy. Well, imagine the year 2000, if I told you that gold would go up 700% after being in a downturn for two decades. But that's exactly what happened. Gold went from 250 in 2000 all the way up to 2020. It got up to 2089, a 735% increase. So the devaluation of the dollar against gold, we can see gold prices reach between 10, 12, or 14,000. And here's the thing you have to understand about inflation. Inflation is every bit as much psychological. Politicians looking at like, oh my God, we raised tax rates from 40% to 70%, but we're not getting more revenues. It's the same thing with inflation. And a best example I can give you is during World War I, Germany decided to finance the war by printing money. But the German people had confidence in their government, confidence in the financial system. Germans bought government bonds to help support the war effort, just as in the U.S. We bought savings bonds during the World War II. It is when confidence is lost, when people lose confidence in authority, whether it's the Treasury, whether it's the Federal Reserve, that is when velocity starts to pick up. And velocity is psychologically dependent, because the Fed printed a whole bunch of money coming out of the financial crisis, but velocity continued to fall. And now we're starting to see just an uptick in velocity, and that's something we're watching very closely, because once velocity starts to increase, once people lose confidence in authorities, in systems, in the media, in our political figures, that's when they lose control. And that's when, as James Carville once said, if he was to be reborn, he would come back as a bond vigilante so I could intimidate governments. That's what will get government attention, is when the bond market starts to assert control. So, Chris, the devaluation I see coming, it's the only way we're going to be able to manage this debt, because it's on an unsustainable path. I mean, if we could, basically print $6-7 trillion a year, every country in the world could do this and they would be just as prosperous as we are. That's not the case. So anyway, devaluation is coming, and it's my prediction it's going to be against gold, because if it's against another currency, it doesn't work.
Well, Jim, given what we discussed today, and like you said, with a great devaluation ahead, what are some of the investment implications that you believe come from this?
You know, I think, Chris, you're going to have to pivot. You're going to have to be active, because the first thing that happens when you go through a market downturn or a crash is things become deflationary. But however, I think this time you could see certain assets do well. So at some point, you're going to want to go short the market. I mean, when it comes, it's going to be fast and furious. But the only hedge you're going to have, if you want to be in stocks, you better have a hedge and the type of stocks you own. So things like staples, necessities, commodities, inflation tip bonds, those are the things that are going to help get you through this cycle. But we believe we're in a long-term super cycle for commodities. If you take a look at the pivot that we're moving from the gas combustion engine to green energy, you know, what is that going to require? Massive amounts of copper, massive amounts of silver, massive amounts of nickel. Oil, I think, is on an upswing as well. So those type of things that, in other words, when money becomes worthless, when we basically devalue money, people put things in things that are going to hold their value, things that are tangible, things like we like residential real estate, things like commodities, things that are tangible. And by the way, Chris, when they devalue, believe it or not, the stock market goes up. I wrote an article, I wrote last year, and I showed what happened to the value of the stock market with the devaluation of a currency. So, but first, we got to get through, we're going through what I call the eat, drink, and be merry phase of the market right now before we get to the downside of all this inflation and money printing. And then you're going to have to work through what comes out of that in terms of the policy response, which eventually will lead to devaluation.
Jim, when it comes to the topic of depression, some of the parallels that we see currently with the Great Depression of the 1930s and what we're building up to, what are some of the reading materials that you had cited earlier? There's a number of different books that I know that you have in your stack and that you are currently reading. What are some of those books that you would recommend for our listeners to pick up?
Yeah, there's a number of things. What I would recommend is go to the website. We've got three charts taken. One is of the labor participation rate, which is down to 61% now. There's a lot more Americans that are out of work than is commonly reported with our unemployment figures. The next one is the tax rates that shows what the tax rates were by year going back to 1913. And then the one that follows that is really the key. It shows what the government takes in as a percentage of the economy, no matter what the tax rates are. So please look at that. Now, let me give you a couple books. The first one is called The New Great Depression. It's Jim Rickard's new book. It just came out in February. Highly recommend reading it. The other one is called The Great Devaluation by Adam Baratta. And then somebody that we've had on FS Insider, George Friedman, his new book, The Storm Before the Calm. And then a new one that just came out last month by Daniel Yergin. It's called The New Map, Energy, Climate, and the Clash of Nations in the New Cold War by Daniel Yergin. And then another book that really gets into why MMT doesn't work. It's called When Money Destroys Nations by Philip Haslam, which is a talk about what went on in Africa with Zimbabwe and some of those African nations that just went through hyperinflation by the things that they did. So these are some things. We are going to be giving you this information because you won't hear this on most financial channels. And what we want you to do is read it. Draw your own conclusions. Read the material. At least you're going to get exposed to different views than what you're getting in the financial media. And you can read it and say, you know what, I think Jim is full of pucky. I don't buy that, but at least you've been exposed to the idea and you can draw your own conclusions, which we would encourage you to do.
Jim, was that a bad word you used there? Mucky?
Pucky.
Pucky. Okay. Pucky. Do I need to bleep that one out?
I don't know. maybe I'll get taken off Twitter or something.
Yeah, you might get canceled for that one.
I might get canceled.
Well, as always, we here at Financial Sense Wealth Management are navigating the markets, the economy. We watch leading economic indicators, inflation gauges, what the Fed is doing, and we try to keep our eye on the ball, as always, as to where things are headed, looking at the big picture like we discussed today. So if you want to get in contact with any of our advisors, either for a financial plan or for our asset management services, you can give our advisors a call at 888, that's 888-486-3939. Also, if you're on financialsense.com already, You can go ahead and hit the Contact Us button and submit a message through our website. On behalf of Financial Sense NewsHour and the Financial Sense Wealth Management team, we hope you have a pleasant weekend.
The Financial Sense NewsHour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the NewsHour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense NewsHour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the NewsHour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.